It's my pleasure today to be talking to Nick Campion in the Square in Solier in Cafe Central, which tends to be our hangout here. Nick has a home here. He spends a lot of time in Solier, but he also has a very different life that keeps him very busy back in the UK. He's also a man that has many parts, because I know that he was a political activist. I know that he was an astrologer. I know that he worked for major newspapers telling us how it was all going to be. And these days, he's working with Prince Charles and the University of Wales. So, Nick, welcome to Boat Radio. And we look forward to you telling us your story.
Well, thank you, Shirley. It's great to be, you know, I'm what we call, or we called a minute ago, a half and half. Half in Solier, half in the UK. So I'm happy to bring both halves together for you.
Now, where do you think you live?
I think I live in cafes because I've got my home in Solier, I've got my home in the UK, and I've got an office in Lampeter in West Wales at the University of Wales, Trinity St David. And as much as possible, I sit in cafes. So that's where I live. As long as I can hear the sound of a good espresso being made, I'm happy.
So the cafe society is important to you then?
I don't think civilization would exist without it.
And is that one of the keys that brought you to this place, to Solier? Because this is the capital of cafe society on this island. That's my opinion.
Yes. Let me just digress for a minute, because I heard once that coffee was banned in Egypt. This may be an urban myth. It was banned because the Sufis said drinking it opened their third eyes. And this, of course, meant they had direct divine inspiration, which was threatening to the normal authorities. So I do believe in coffee. I believe coffee opens up the imagination, the creative juices, and it makes people friends. So yes, Solier has the most wonderful collection of cafes around the Central Plaza and just off it. And actually, this is the third cafe I've been to this morning.
But it has to be said that, for the record for our worldwide listeners, that it's only 10:30. What have you been doing? What time did you get up?
I was up about 5 o'clock, read the newspaper online, and then I went to Savia, a wonderful cafe just down the street from here, where I met up with my friend Jeff McEwen, the artist, and we put the world to rights. Then I went to a Cafe Fawn where I sat for a while, did some editing, and my partner, Wendy, came in on her way to the beach. And then I thought I'd come here, have some bacon and eggs and wait for you and this amazing event.
So this is a three-cafe day already. And how many, by the time the night falls tonight on Solier Square, how many cafes will you have been in?
Well, I might switch to bars after this, so maybe it could be a three-bar night.
A three-bar night. Now, what are you going to do on a three-bar night? What's your route?
Well, let's maybe have a gin and tonic at Bar Turismo, move next door for a glass of Bisbal at the Union, and climax with a nice yerbas at the Café Follier. I wasn't expecting that.
Oh dear. Yeah,
that's all the bottles that people have drunk going into the recycling.
That's you and the bottles in the course of the day, right. Okay. Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of the Cafe Society, so I'm completely with you on that. And I think that Woody Allen could have written his script here for his latest film on exactly that, the whole Cafe Society. But let's just take you back to political activist North London days.
Yes, the Labour Party. I mean, everybody's getting very excited about Jeremy Corbyn now, but frankly, you know, been there, done that, got the T-shirt. I was secretary of Camden Town Ward Labour Party in the late 70s for a couple of years. And, well, they are getting excited. I don't know if that's for Jeremy Corbyn or against him. And I was on the executive committee, the constituency and the management committee. I got involved through squatting politics. I was lived in a big street of squats in Camden Town. A few of us got very tired of waiting to be evicted, so we joined the local Labour Party. Suddenly found that the Labour Party is a huge coalition of different interests and factions, and we found ourselves with a whole group of allies, what I'd call the liberal left, the democratic left, as opposed to, you know, there's the anti-democratic left and the right of various kinds. So the liberal left, all very, very nice, wonderful people. And so I ended up being part of this whole group in the Labour Party. I was quite evangelical about it at the time. I thought if only enough really nice people joined the Labour Party and it got into power, we could have a nicer country, which does sound like Corbynism at the moment. Then I found out that actually the Labour Party is not that democratic, and it was all controlled from the top down. Local democracy was overruled, and so I left in 1979 in disgust. I did think vaguely of do I like Jeremy Corbyn or not, but it seems to me that they're playing out the same thing, because there's all these Corbynistas who think that the world can be a better place, but actually there's still the attempt to control from the top and manipulate and so on. So I think it's this. I think it's, you know, deja vu all over again.
That's very interesting. But Corbynistas, did you pen that word? Is that original?
No. No, it's around in all the press, isn't it, the Corbynistas?
Right, okay. So the Corbynistas sounds like a line dance troupe.
Maybe that's something else that they could do in the evenings, yes, once they've had their jolly meetings.
Let me take you now to where your fame, as far as the written word is concerned, began, because you had a long career as the Daily Mail astrologer. And then I believe that it was Jonathan Kaner who took over after you, but you had years of the Daily Mail. You were the astrologer of choice of many people. Tell us how you ever got into that.
Well, it's one of those long stories. I was actually on the Daily Mail for 6 years, but astrology was a childhood interest. I was just fascinated by its claim to be able to draw pictures of people's lives based on their date of birth, and, you know, to connect the dots in the universe to make big patterns. And I loved it as a child. My mother used to read the horoscopes out of the paper at breakfast, and I just used to sit there spellbound. So in my teens, whenever I could, I searched secondhand bookshops for books on it, and then I taught myself how to calculate a full horoscope or birth chart, which is, you set up for the time and date and place of somebody's birth, and it's got all the planets in it, and it's quite, can get quite complex. So I taught myself to do that. And when I left university, actually left London University with an MA in the politics, international relations and history of Southeast Asia, and there weren't that many jobs going in that area.
What a surprise.
No, in fact, when I went to the job centre and I told them that's what my skill was, they just rolled their eyes to the ceiling and wrote me a cheque. But anyway, I began to study things, and I began to write a bit about the history of astrology, because history is my first love. And so about 1985, I found myself with no money, no income and nothing to do. So I'll just write about history anyway, because that'll keep me going. So I wrote to a man called John Naylor, and his claim to fame is that his father wrote the first horoscope column in an English newspaper, in the Sunday Express in 1930. He wrote an article about the birth of Princess Margaret. This was huge news at the time. Caught the whole country. This was big stuff. Everybody was fascinated. So I wrote to John Naylor and asked him a question about his father. And he said, he wrote back this lovely letter. "Dear Mr. Campion, I don't know what you're talking about, but do you know anybody who wants some freelance journalism?" And of course, there's me sitting, you know, in my eating my last crust of bread and glass of water. "Yes, me, please." And so he wrote back and said, "Dear Mr. Campion, I'll meet you in 6 months' time in the lobby of the British Museum when I've got back from my house in Spain, where I'm going for the winter." And so the day came, and I was sitting in the lobby of the British Library thinking, will he turn up? Will he turn up? And in he came, and I knew what he looked like. I went up and said, "Mr. Naylor, it's Nick Campion." And he said, "Mr. Campion, let's sit down on this bench." And he had these carrier bags full of duplicated features and bits of horoscope he'd written. And he said, "And this one's for this magazine, and that one goes to that country, and this is the Daily Mail." And then he said, "I know. Let's go and tell my agent and tell her you're taking over." I said, "Well, shouldn't we phone first?" He said, no, come on, come on." And so we got in his car and drove half a mile from Bloomsbury to Holborn. And he said, "Sit in the car, wait there." And he went in for half an hour and then came out and waved me in. And there I was presented to this shell-shocked agent, Doreen Montgomery, who I still work with at the Rupert Crewe Agency in. She was looking shell-shocked, and she said, "Well, you know, you'd better buy the same size paper as John and write your copy in exactly the same way, and we won't tell the Daily Mail you're taking over." And I found out it was only a long time later I remarked to her I'd only met John that morning, half an hour previously, and he'd just given his job of 30 years to somebody he'd met 30 minutes ago. So it was all quite, it was that remarkable.
Well, was this in the stars then that you were going to do this? I'm sure you've been asked that question before.
Yes, well, it must have been, mustn't it? But what, I don't know. Actually, you know, we do all come from the stars. So yes, every atom, every shred of energy in our bodies has been through three previous stars, the last of which was our own sun. So, you know, the old song says we're stardust. Joni Mitchell sang "We're Stardust." So, yes.
So you got away with this then. So Mr. Naylor gives you the job. You've got the agent in and she tells you what to do. But you don't have a byline of your own name at that point within the paper.
It was all done under the byline Orion, which is one of the big constellations in the sky. So after about 2 years, those taped horoscope phone lines had come along, you know, dial this number and for 3 minutes you get your reading. And the Daily Mail was the last major newspaper to do that. But one by one, all the newspapers were discovering this source of income and then promoting their horoscope columns. So one day the Mail phoned my agent, Doreen, and said, "Who's writing our horoscope column?" And she, brazening it out, said, "Why, Nicholas Campion, of course." And they said, "Does he take a good photograph?" That's all they were interested in. She said, "Well, yes, of course he does." So there followed an exciting few weeks. I was, you know, whisked off to Daily Mail to meet the editor and go for a boozy lunch in Fleet Street before the paper departed, while Fleet Street still existed, and had photo shoots. And you know, there was a big launch. And that was 1988. So I had another 4 years after that of high profile life as a media astrologer. And incredibly interesting it was as well, working for a national newspaper and finding out how they work and actually the grim reality of it, because they're feudal setups. You know, they're not nice cozy democracies, as I'm sure you know. And you know, the editor is God, and the editor then was David English. So as long as David English was there, I was his pet, so I was protected. And then the editor changed, and lots of the hierarchy below changed, and suddenly I was yesterday's man. And so gradually things got more and more unpleasant until we parted company and Jonathan Kaner took over. He told me he was taking over first, actually, because we were old friends. So he phoned me up and said, "Nick, the Daily Mail just offered me your job." So without the Daily Mail knowing, we managed to get the best out of it.
But the commitment of being a newspaper astrologer, I mean, you're writing 7 days a week, you're doing a bigger piece at the weekend, you're doing special stuff at the end of the year. I mean, this is a serious full-time job.
Yes. I think the main thing was trying to make it interesting. So, you know, you've got your 12 paragraphs from Aries to Pisces through the 12 signs. And the way I began to see this was actually as writing a thought for the day. I always like thought for the day, BBC Radio 4. And so it's really a thought for the day. And people would ask me, you know, do you base it on astrology? To which I would say yes, because it was easier to, because just to make up something without looking at the planets or the zodiac signs was more difficult. So I do that. But then I realised actually each 50 word section is a little piece of biography of somebody's life. And you can't say much. There are things you can't say. You can't depress people. You can't talk about sex. You know, sex is called romance. That's the euphemism for sex. You know, good day for romance. You know, that's code. There's lots of things you can't say, but you have to come up with this, you know, 50 words. So you try and just, you almost write something archetypal about the way people's lives are going and the way they feel. It's almost like a thought for the day, or a riddle, some of them are. And people then read them and they have to interpret them individually, because you can't, you're writing one paragraph and several hundred thousand people or more may read it, and so everybody has to bring their individual interpretation to it. So it's as if you're writing almost like an empty vessel into which people can read something. So to make it interesting for myself, sometimes instead of going from Aries to Pisces, I'd start at Pisces and work backwards, or start in the middle with Virgo and go to Pisces then. Or I'd start on Friday and go back to Monday. Then I'd go to Friday, then Wednesday, then Thursday. Anywhere I could to mix it up. And
But your life at that time then presumably wasn't just the Daily Mail astrologer, because other people would have wanted your skills as well. Presumably there are other magazines that were after you at the same time.
Well, that's right, because what happens on women's magazines is as soon as an editor changes, they change a lot of the freelancers. So they can't change the regular staff. To make their mark, they change the freelancers. And they look to where they can get somebody new. And obviously the national press is a good source of talent. So yes, I did. I worked for a lot of women's magazines. But I had about three or four really, really good editors. And when they moved on, they would take me with them. So I worked for, I guess the big ones were Vogue. And that was under a pseudonym. And Harper's Bazaar in the USA. So for a while, I would go to New York for lunch, which was really quite a thing, you know. For a young lad who once had been a labour activist squatter.
Well, a labour activist squatter, that's one thing. And then with a degree that sort of can give you a job in Southeast Asia, to being the society astrologer of choice for many years in the UK. What about private readings? Did you do private readings?
Well, I did for a few years. And then I gave up. And I remember thinking to myself, I'd rather dig holes in the road than do another private reading. Anything, please, save me. Because you've got to have a particular gift, I think, if you want to talk to people about their problems. I had a number of issues with doing this job. To start off with, you have this piece of paper, and on the piece of paper are these hieroglyphics that are supposed to tell you about somebody's past, present, and future. And I never quite trusted that I could do that. I didn't have the faith. You know, I was always a bit sceptical, because, you know, I've been an undergraduate studying history at Cambridge. And one thing they teach you there as a history student is that there's no certainty about anything. You can challenge anything. Whatever it is people are saying, you can, the fashionable phrase is deconstruct it. You can take it to bits. And so I'd be there with my sheet of paper with this circles and squiggles on it, never quite trusting it would work. So I'd be in an immense state of tension I'm sure it worked, you know, used to wipe years off my life, and then somebody would come. It always go well because there's a little, you can have a conversation. But then I got tired of people's problems. So I hope nobody I did a reading for listens to this, but, you know, people would come along and they'd say, oh, you know, I don't, mainly women, I don't know what to do about my boyfriend. You know, he's really horrible to me. And I'd be thinking, well, just leave him then. You know, what's wrong with you? You're 25 years old. You know, leave him. Or they'd say, I don't know what to do for a profession. And I'd have to be terribly sympathetic. And I'd be thinking, just get a job stacking shelves. Just do something. You know, just get out there. Stop sitting at home navel-gazing. And so I think I've got a little bit of the Protestant work ethic. You know, I'd think to people, just get on with it. And so I didn't have that touch you need to sit and listen to people very gently. And I think I could do it, but inside I was thinking I want to do something else. So I decided to become a writer and write about history. I wanted to go back and be a historian, read books, read manuscripts, and dabble. And I ended up writing some major books on the history of astrology.
So you're still in astrology, though. I mean, astrology is a very big part of your life even now.
Well, what I do now is, what I've done for the last 15 years really is the history and culture of astrology. So, you know, the books I've written include a book called Astrology and Cosmology in the World's Religions, which I did for New York University Press a few years ago. And it's got different chapters, and so astrology, religion, and views of the cosmos in amongst Australian Aborigines, in Islam, in Christianity, in China, in India, so different chapters. So that's what I really like doing, and I still do a lot of research. So I did my PhD because while I was in the media, I was always being phoned up by journalists. So say, the editor wants us to do a feature on astrology and say how many people believe in it and why. And so to start off with, I'd give them some kind of answer. Then I realised nobody knew the answer to those questions. So I thought, well, I'll go and do a PhD. And I found a very congenial home in a religious studies department passed by university, and as part of that I ended up talking to people, and I gave about 1,000 questionnaires out at astrology conferences, and I did 60 interviews with astrologers to try and build up, you know, a sociological, anthropological view of how astrology works in the modern world. So even though, you know, I haven't done it for a long, 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 long time, I still find it really fascinating as a area of culture. I've got lots of friends who are in the world of astrology and so on. I can do it, I have to. But my real love is culture, finding out what people think. I love talking to people, actually. I only discovered that recently after deciding I didn't want people to talk to me when I was doing horoscope readings. 20 years later, I discovered the pleasure of interviewing people to draw them out and find out what they think.
Nick, just to before we go on to the next phase and talk about your university world, tell us what your mum thought of your career within the astrology world.
I think she was a little bit disturbed when I first said, having got my clutch of academic degrees, Mum, I want to be an astrologer. I don't think that went down too well, particularly because it was when I was also squatting and active in the Labour Party. But once I got the job on the Daily Mail, it was all change because, you know, the Daily Mail it's the house magazine of the conservative world, and she's a natural conservative, as were all her friends. And so she'd go up to the golf club and her friends would say, oh, I saw Nikki in the paper this morning, and she'd glow with pride. So yes, there was a sudden change from being unmentionable to being something to dine out on.
That's nice, that's good.
And also, of course, I did always tell her she was responsible because it was her who read out the horoscopes at breakfast, and got me into the whole thing anyway.
So did she take seriously what you said about her star sign?
I never said anything about hers. It's very, very difficult to do astrology for somebody you're very close to. Like you can't do anything else for them. You know, if you're a GP, you wouldn't want to start giving medicine to your own family, for example. So it's not really possible. So,
but she was proud. She was proud of her boy. That's lovely, lovely, yeah. Lovely. Well, let's go on now to the next phase then. So the astrology doors came to a close, and you moved on with your writing and your research and your PhD. And where did you end up?
Well, I've ended up now at the University of Wales, Trinity St David, which has campuses now in Swansea, Carmarthen, and it's got buildings in Cardiff and London, and my actual campus is in Lampeter in the far west of Wales. It's absolutely lovely, it's beautiful, I love it, I love the people there. It's native Welsh speaking, and even though I don't speak more than a few words of Welsh, I love the fact that it's native Welsh speaking. It's a different culture. I love it, and so I've got an office there, and I usually go there once a week because I'm only part-time. But all my teaching's online. So we use webinars. I've got students all over the world. We've had students from Hong Kong, Russia, to Brazil, Argentina, Canada, of course, Turkey, and obviously a lot in the UK.
And what is the subject you teach?
Well, my specialist area is the MA in Cultural Astronomy and Astrology, which I set up with some colleagues after I did my PhD back in 2002 at Bath Spa University. And a lot of people, and I'm sure some listeners to this, will be surprised when I say astronomy and astrology, because the two are such cultural loggerheads in the modern world. You know, astronomy is a science, and astrology, a lot of people say, is a superstition. Although I normally say astronomy is about measuring the heavenly bodies, and astrology is about attributing meaning to them. That meaning might be something quite ordinary, like for navigation, what direction do I need to go in? But there's a smooth progression from there to say, well, what does that star mean about some divine plan, or what's happening tomorrow, or, you know, because the whole world in traditional cultures is often seen as alive and brimming with meaning. So, you know, a bird flies overhead, or the wind ruffles some leaves in a tree, and it can mean something. So in traditional cultures, anything in the sky can mean something. The color of the sky, the full moon, the sunrise, where a star is. And so that idea that the sky has meaning exists in all traditional cultures, and it's the root of modern astrology. So the course looks at, I call it the history and anthropology of our relationship with the sky. History, how do people look at the sky in the past? Anthropology, how do they look at it now?
So your students then, your typical student worldwide, is he or she doing with this course, or is it just for intellectual interest, or is there a practical application?
It's intellectual interest, really. Look, for the purposes of the modern university, you have to set out employability skills. So, you know, we say the students learn time management and so on. That's the official view, but actually, what people really want is education for quality of life. And so all the people that come on the course have got an interest somehow in the sky. Quite a lot of them are people who studied astrology or practiced it, but who want something more. They want to look at astrology culturally, study its history, understand the kinds of claims it makes. And we've got other people who come in from an astronomy background who find that, you know, university courses in astronomy just often deal heavily with mathematics. In fact, in the real world, astronomy is connected to literature, poetry, painting, architecture, And so there's this new emerging academic discipline called cultural astronomy. And there's various conferences and networks on that where people talk about astronomy and culture. So I bring that together with astrology and culture.
Is yours the only university course of its kind?
It is. It is unique. Yeah, long may it remain so, because the students have to come to us. So that's great.
And is Lampeter particularly significant in alternative subjects?
From time to time it is. They've had very good MAs in, for example, Celtic studies, which you would expect from there. Arthurian studies used to teach, so, you know, writings and critiques of writings about King Arthur and related topics. Right now they are leading on sustainability. The Welsh government says it's the only government in the world to have written sustainability objectives into its official government plans. And so the University of Wales, Trinity St David, is actually taking that forward. So we're working out what sustainability means, what it is. And the United Nations has got a sustainability agenda. It's got something called the 2030 Agenda, where we can move towards a more, you know, sustainable planet, preserving water, clean air and so on. Yeah.
So you have your three-pronged life then. You have this beautiful location in Lampeter. You have your home, one home in Bristol, and then you have your solo life. So you come here, and is this to get a different perspective here? Is there anything that changes how you think about anything from your living here?
Just purely in terms of my writing, when I'm here I get a much greater sense of clarity. When I'm here I bring my own editing and writing, and I do feel much... I get a clearer perspective. In fact, the clearer perspective happens on the plane. I suddenly feel the burdens of excessive bureaucracy and administration in the UK slipping away. And then I get off the plane at Palma and I take a big, deep breath, and I jump in a taxi and arrive in Solier. And yes, it's a lot more relaxed here. In fact, I get a little bit too relaxed here.
But just tell us, just before we finish, how you actually found Solier or the Solier Valley.
Well, in a series of lucky meetings, my partner Wendy, who's a dancer, was dancing at the Jerusalem Festival. Around the mid-90s, I think now. And a woman called Hannah Sachs was involved in the festival and held a big party for the performers. And we went to her house and became friends, and we kept in touch. And then she invited us to a birthday party here in Solier, because in the meantime, she'd moved from Jerusalem to Solier via various other stages in her life. So she invited us to her birthday party, and we came. And Wendy is of Sicilian background, had always been wanting a home in the Mediterranean. So we came here, and this was suddenly the perfect spot. I think on day one, probably, we thought, this is it. And we stayed at the Hotel Via on the plaza, just a few feet away from where we are now, and kept coming back until we bought an apartment here. It's now 5 years ago. It seems like 5 weeks ago, but it's actually 5 years ago. And we've been leading this half and half existence now for 5 years.
But your life here, had you ever been to Mallorca before, or had you ever been to Solier before this party?
No, never to Mallorca. In fact, my image of Mallorca is probably what a lot of people's is, which is basically British package tourists. I'd no idea that the island was so big, so beautiful, so extraordinary, the people so wonderful, and that a place like Solier, this piece of paradise, existed.
And as far as Solier itself, yes, we do live in a paradise. I completely agree. It's really beautiful. But the people, they're just an odd bunch of people here, aren't they?
That's probably why I feel as if I fit right in.
I completely agree with that. And that's a good moment to finish this interview and to thank you for giving us your time and telling us your story, which is absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much, Nick.
Thank you, Shirley.
All the night sky.